Dans votre slide sur les finances de Londres, vous indiquez la part de l'État. Est-ce que vous avez des comparaisons avec les autres métropoles comparables en Europe ou dans les pays occidentaux sur l'influence donc, de la part de l'État dans le financement? Et éventuellement, autre question de comparaison, dans la gouvernance de Londres avec les arrondissements, avec le Mayor, est-ce qu'il y a des similitudes ou des comparaisons avec les autres, justement les autres métropoles et les autres capitales européennes identiques ou comparables? Et, alors, je ne sais pas si justement on a ces comparaisons-là, et si le mode d'organisation peut expliquer un dynamisme ou un frein dans le développement d'une capitale en fonction de sa gouvernance et de ses financements.
Je compléterai juste sur le discours de chiffres.
Oui, ton micro.
Thank you. Juste pour compléter, je pose la question en français.
Peut-être plutôt pour
monsieur Brown. Donc, pour compléter cette question, on a eu du mal à identifier en préparant le voyage. Le poids des finances locales en comparaison, le poids des finances des dépenses locales dans le PIB par exemple, au Royaume-Uni, pour se rendre compte un peu de mesurer l'écart de décentralisation entre les deux pays. Par exemple, en France, je ne sais pas, les dépenses locales c'est dans 11% du PIB, quelque chose comme ça. We have a percent of GDP in France. What would be the figure in the United Kingdom? I have no idea.
As far as I can understand, we had a London Finance Commission a few years ago to try to push for more devolution of finances. And I'm trying to remember the exact comparisons, but that compared London, New York, and Tokyo. And in London, I think it's 7% of expenditure is locally generated, 7% of public. And I think in New York and Tokyo, it was maybe 11 and 20%. I'll check the number and which way around those are. So it is significantly less local discretion over finances, and significantly less power over how local taxes are set. There are central government limits on what level of tax rise can be created every year, and it's a very complicated process, but the ratio between the highest tax and the lowest tax is also set by central government, so it's a very centralised system. In terms, I think, the second question, before my French gave up, about the relationships between the two tiers of government. I think the boroughs have more power, for example, than the New York boroughs do. In New York, a lot more services are provided by the City of New York, and the five boroughs are more geographical organising institutions. There are some services provided at the borough or even the ward level in New York, but most of them. In others, I'm not so sure about service provision by arrondissement or even in the Berlin system, what the balance is. But I suppose the difference has been that the Greater London Authority is an institution that was placed on top of pre-existing local government institutions rather than devised together. I think there is a question, maybe it's another topic, of whether a different arrangement in other cities at the moment, they now have a mayor who is first among equals from the boroughs within that city, within Greater Manchester, for example, and whether there is more sharing of power, and whether it's time to look again at London's governance and see whether a different approach is necessary. The question about GDP, though, I'm not sure of the answer.
The part of local, the share of local government expenses or investment, yeah, in GDP, just to be able to compare with things.
Yeah. I don't know, but it seems to me that these statistics are very hard to make sensible comparison with, yeah, politically. In terms of, as Richard was saying, there's a question about who formally funds it.
There's also a question about who takes the policy decisions as to what it is that's going to take place and what the level of services that's provided. So Richard was making a very strong point in relation to education, that a lot of it is funded effectively locally. But there is very little room for variation in this. And the more that there's been austerity imposed upon local government generally, then the scope for there being real local decision making is substantially reduced, I think. Can I say something a little bit background in relation to the politics of this here, which I don't, I think somewhere between what Lisa was saying and what Richard was saying hasn't quite been said, which is that the Greater London Authority was designed to be impotent, right? So the Blair New Labour government, no more than Thatcher, wanted to have a powerful London authority which could have a significant role in national politics. Right? And so the old London County Council, and then the Greater London Council as it operated, had been a classic political machine in the sense that they provided mass Fordist kinds of services in terms of housing and education, which brought in a vote, a reliable vote for not left Labour, but mainstream Labour. And all that potential power was taken away from the Greater London Authority. So the fact that the duties of the mayor to start with were entirely strategic, to write 13 strategies or something like that, that wasn't a forward-looking thing, but it was just trying to remove back to the boroughs anything which might directly give power to it. And one of the, and I just want to say one more beyond that. Part of my reservations about the global city notion is exactly related to this. So one of the things which happened by design, I guess, with the Livingston administration was that they were desperate to get money. Congestion charging came in because, I think, it was the only new tax power which was offered to the mayor. Central government itself lost its courage in relation to congestion taxing, but London was the one place that implemented it because it was desperate for money, as well as having views about the environment. But beyond that, in order to get funding for any infrastructure projects, the Chancellor of the Exchequer had to be on the side of the mayor. Right? And so my understanding of what happened in the first 2 years of the Livingston administration, or something quite dramatically in this, is that the whole global city notion came to the fore as a way of pushing the button of the Chancellor of the Exchequer for infrastructure projects, and specifically for the infrastructure project which would most directly serve the interests of the city, namely Crossrail. Right? And Crossrail, as far as I understand it, was never the favoured project of Transport for London. It was somewhere in the top 10 projects, but it wasn't at the top of the priorities. But it became central to the agenda, and the London plan took the form that it did under Livingstone, then continued the others, because that's how you got funding out of central government, for things that you wanted, as well as things that central government wanted. So the numbers are not the whole of the story, but they do actually signal, I think, some of the other politics that's going on there. Richard, having been there, might have a different perception than I do.
I think there's a lot in that. I think the mayor would have argued, if he was sitting here in his characteristic tone, that the congestion charge was all about reducing congestion and all the money was reinvested in the services to meet the needs of people who are priced out, who are not going to use their cars. But I think the important thing about the congestion charge was also that it was supported by this unlikely coalition to anyone who'd been around in the 1980s of Ken Livingstone and London's business organisations. And I think the thing that surprised everyone about Ken Livingstone is, notwithstanding when he became mayor, the continued focus on social equity and environmental issues, he also aligned himself very closely with business lobbies in London in making the case to the Chancellor, and surprised, I think, certainly people in the Labour Party by, rather than being the municipal socialist firebrand of 1986, becoming a, albeit slightly reluctant, friend of business, because seeing that in the context of getting money out of central government and in the context of using growth to drive social change, he could not be anything else but allied with the business lobby in London, which also, and I didn't say this, has increasingly seen issues such as congestion and house prices as a major inhibitor for them to be able to recruit and retain the workers they want. So there was a genuine alliance of interest, but also a shared interest in making the global city argument.
Just to push that point a bit further, the business lobby, certainly at the beginning, was the Central London Business Lobby. So London First was a lobby group which represented, as far as I remember it, city interests, West End interests, Heathrow Airport interests, and Grand Metropolitan Hotels. That was essentially it. And there was a privileged, there were four, I think, people who met regularly with a mayoral representative during the Livingston era. And all of those, apart from an London Chamber of Commerce one, I think, were tied specifically to this, to that particular lobby. So it wasn't representing London business in general, but it was this particular conception of what London business would be about, for better or for worse.
And I suppose remains the representative, I suppose, still, maybe not so central anymore, but still of the corporatist, large bureaucratic businesses and those investing in real estate rather than necessarily small businesses. And small businesses whose trade is primarily within London, as illustrated by Ian's slide.
Ma question est principalement pour Ian Gordon. Vous avez parlé de Londres et de la région métropolitaine de Londres comme une ville globale. On a eu beaucoup de données, alors en critiquant le concept hein, d'ailleurs, et vous nous avez donné beaucoup de données sur le développement de cette région métropolitaine, mais finalement, en nous parlant peu de comment cette ville-monde interagit avec le reste du monde, d'où viennent les populations de travailleurs qui émigrent, quels sont les principaux flux partenaires financiers dans le monde, quelles sont éventuellement les autres villes en concurrence. Et du coup, quand on parle d'une ville-monde soutenable, ça suppose de projeter, si on parle de ville-monde, dans une image mondiale. Donc, est-ce que c'est quelque chose que vous regardez, que vous interrogez, comment cette question de la soutenabilité, mais en fait d'un modèle posé dans un paysage mondial?
So a very long question, some of which I didn't grasp because the French was interacting with the English. But to go to the last thing about the idea that it should be an exemplary, sustainable global city, I think you have to see that as being an advertising slogan. So it compacts together a set of different desirable concepts, not all necessarily subscribed to by exactly the same people. So it's going to be a global city because the first plan said, that London had to accommodate an inevitable growth in its economy. Why was it inevitable? It was inevitable because it was a global city and because there was a drive to global cities. So that was a central line of argument. Sustainability was very largely in terms of compaction, as Richard was saying. So the notion that the growth should be accommodated within London might have been desirable in order to get resources, but it was certainly seen as desirable in environmental terms. I think somewhat mistaken myself, but that it had to be inside London, that would actually deliver environmental gains. That was an important strand in the argument. But I'm the exemplary, well, of course, we're trying to market ourselves and project, and we want to be at the forefront and so on. But I think you have to see these words as being kind of advertising slogans which speak to themes that are there for different sorts of reasons, some of which are very good reasons, and other of which are to do with politics. So what did the plan say, are you asking, about who the rivals were and how they should be competed with? Because I think the conception of the global city then went with a notion of hierarchy and the rivals being essentially New York, but maybe New York was our partner, and then being the European rivals. There was a study from 1991, I think, which I had something, it was on the steering committee on, which was called London World City, which had exactly this notion of a sort of one kind of global competition with New York and Tokyo, and then a European level of competition, though it didn't take that very seriously. And I think, on the whole, the GLA has never taken competition with European centres at all seriously. It's tended to think that it's triumphed in Europe, and the issue is now how you promote London in the global hierarchy, maybe against Singapore and Hong Kong, as well as the conventional ones. But I don't think there's been a very targeted effort to deal with European competition or complementarities.
It was not your question. Tu peux la formuler, hein?
C'est une question complémentaire autour de l'effet de ruissellement dont on parle énormément en France et qui n'a pas l'air d'être un sujet spécialement traité en Angleterre, en tout cas en Grande-Bretagne.
Excusez-moi, il n'a pas compris le début.
Ou d'entraînement, c'est...
Que tu peux répéter.
Est-ce que l'effet de ruissellement, qui est une notion dont on parle beaucoup en France, mais pas uniquement, est questionné ici? Parce que c'est le cas en France, et pas que. Et la situation qui est décrite à Londres pose la question de ce lien avec les autres territoires. C'est le partage de la richesse, ou le fait d'être dynamique et d'entraîner les autres territoires dans cette dynamique.
Vous pouvez poser vos questions en anglais. Ouais.
Ouais, parce que oui, c'est mort.
Bonjour. Yes. It's obviously become, there was a very intense debate, and I think this afternoon you're meeting with Michael Edwards, who will speak eloquently on these. On these matters.
I think it's a different question. What you were talking about?
The trickle down
off London, on the other area.
Outside.
On the rest of the country. Okay. Also inside. But,
On the rest of the UK or on the rest of the wider Southeast?
In the rest of the UK.
Also yes. My think tank recently did a report on this. Where we looked at, this had a long history, this goes back to 18th century complaints about London as this great sore on the face of England, and London being seen as something other from the rest of the UK, and something that stole the young and beautiful and intelligent from the rest of the country, and you took their talent.
Destroyed their beauty.
So London has always had some degree of tension. I think this has accentuated in recent years. I think London has fallen into a trap of either of simply arguing we make fiscal transfers to you, our tax revenues support your hospitals, therefore you should be thankful for us. And I think that is undoubtedly true. I think I'm trying to remember the cross subsidy. There's huge cross subsidy from taxes generated in London to the rest of the UK. But at the same time, there's an argument that is still riding on workers in the rest of the UK, riding on production in the rest of the UK. B, it just creates more of a polarising narrative. And I think Ian talked about London as a capital city. We did some survey work of whether people felt proud of London as their capital city. And the further you got away from London, the less proud people were of London as a capital. It's perhaps not surprising. There was good news as well. The more people visited London, the more they liked it. But on the other hand, the people who don't like London never visit. The one piece of good news was that everybody outside London thought Londoners were arrogant, but Londoners thought that everybody outside would think that even more than they did. So Londoners expected their perception to be worse than it actually was. So I think there is a challenge in terms of perception, there's a challenge in terms of redistribution. I think the solution to that is very difficult, though. We've talked of things such as making stronger links in terms of trade and in terms of supply chains across the country, in terms of joint trade missions overseas, in terms of bringing people from the regions into London, in terms of taking bits of government out and putting them in the regions. But none of these really gets to the nub of this, which is, is it possible to actually redistribute economic activity out of London, as we tried to in the 1960s and 70s, without simply damaging the UK economy as a whole? And I think that's the big, difficult question.
I think there is... Trickle-down is a very loaded expression, because it implies that actually wealth is going down to people and so on. I'm not convinced by that. On the other hand, I do think the market actually works rather strongly in relation to this, and it is true that, as I was saying, anything that is routinizable, right? I don't mean it's routine, but anything you can imagine being done in a more routine way, people will find ways of doing, because it's so incredibly expensive to operate in the city. Right, and either firms concerned or rivals will find a way of doing it somewhere else, if it's possible to do it without face-to-face contact. If you can separate the face-to-face contact element and localize that within the city or within the city region or the wider region, and shunt other things further out, then I think it's happening, and I think it's been happening for the last 70 years and probably beyond that. No, the market seems to me to respond really very strongly. Now, it doesn't send out anywhere nodes for autonomous centres to exist. I mean, except for moving small bits of the BBC to Salford in Manchester and a few initiatives like that, nothing's been taken from the top, but there is trickling down that certainly happens. If you look at what's happened, there used to be secretarial jobs in London, right? They don't exist any longer. You know, they're somewhere else because nobody can afford to employ them. There's lots of things of that kind, I think.
Sorry, now we're discussing.
The core of our preoccupation today.
Three more points briefly. One is the risk is with those routinizable jobs that may have moved out of London is that they are also now the automatable jobs. And so those routine clerical roles. For example, JP Morgan makes a lot of having a big back office function in Bournemouth in the south of England. The risk is that those are the first jobs to perhaps be automated, those jobs themselves may be quite precarious. Two more things, because I know you're going outside London visiting other UK cities. And one is, there's a dimension of this which is increasingly, I think, cities versus rural and peripheral areas rather than London versus other cities. So, actually the most deprived place in the UK is in Essex, east of London, not in the north of England, by standard measures. And I think the challenge between the big urban centres of Manchester, Birmingham, Sheffield, Leeds, Newcastle, Liverpool, and some of the outlying towns, which may be less economically diversified, have a bigger challenge, I think, and particularly seaside towns. Those are becoming stronger elements in the national debate on these matters. Another slightly provocative point is that the UK has a particular pattern of regional development, where we have this cluster of industrial cities in the north of England, all quite near to each other. And to a certain extent, in many senses, they would be seen as part of the same urban cluster. But much as there has been a resurgence of city government in those cities, there's no sense of thinking which is the hub and which is the spokes of those cities at this stage. Where, is the obvious place for the agglomeration of the northern English economy to be in Manchester, and what does that mean for places like Leeds and Liverpool? Now, that's a very contentious area, because if you said that to someone from Liverpool, you wouldn't get a very friendly response. But I think there is a sense to which these cities are very close together, and there is some issue among an economic geographer of how their economic geography is actually functioning.
Can I just say, I think that's a real opportunity. And it's one of the things that struck me recent years is the comparison between the London-Manchester relationship and situation and the Paris-Lyon. Both in terms of, I think that Manchester has been dramatically more successful in getting its political act together for reasons that have probably got a 19th century roots to them than London has. And London is very bad at cooperating, partly because of the history of the city getting in the way over 1,000 years. But lots of things in London are about disorganisation, I think. I'll come back to that in a second. And whereas in Lyon and Manchester it's quite different, and the kinds of initiatives that have been taken in the two places in the last 30 years, building up capacity systematically, seem to me to be very, very similar in character. But Lyon doesn't have this hinterland of other industrial cities around it that, that Manchester could benefit from, and there could be a second real centre to it. Can I just say one other thing about this disorganisation? Because it seems to me that more than I probably said at the beginning, the agglomeration economy effects of London particularly are to do with, well, if you have different kinds of notions of how industrial clusters operate, there's one which is about pure agglomeration, which is just about things being next door to each other. So that next week, next month, next year, in unexpected circumstances, when you need a new customer, a new supplier, a new patron, a new client, a new source of information, it's lying around there. And I think it's the kind of the city as a singles bar, is the way in which it operates. So it brings together lots of actors who have unpredictable demands and unpredictable capacities, and see the advantages being lying around in this place. And if you have more, and that's true socially as well, so we have lots and lots of single people in the city for good social reasons as well as good job reasons. And some of what's true of Tech City and so on is about the advantages of living in inner London for people who are young, single, qualified, socially as well as job terms. The second order industrial cities don't operate like that. They're much better for marriages, if you think about it this way, for stable relationships between investors. But if you have stable relationships, in business terms, they're much better off somewhere else than in London, paying high rents in order to cope with this economic promiscuity, which I think, I mean, it's a coarse metaphor, but I think it's quite a good way of understanding the disorganisation of this city and New York and Paris to some degree, and what differentiates them from the second-order industrial cities that have quite strong institutions and quite as well as some scale to them.
Il est où?
Merci. Oui, j'aurais voulu vous poser deux questions. Une première question très, très, très ponctuelle sur ce que j'ai pas entendu dans les différentes interventions, la part de Londres dans le produit national brut de la Grande-Bretagne dans son ensemble. Et puis la deuxième question, peut-être que vous pouvez répondre à cette première
question. 30%.
30%, c'est un peu je crois, comme Paris par rapport au reste de la France. La deuxième question porte sur le marché du logement. Puisque vous avez montré dans l'un des graphiques qu'il y avait une forte augmentation des coûts du logement, donc des prix, alors j'imagine, à l'achat. Et j'ai vu une deuxième courbe sur les prix des loyers, dans lesquels les loyers finalement avaient augmenté, mais de manière moins rapide, moins forte que le prix des logements. Donc est-ce qu'il y a donc, une part plus importante, j'imagine, de locataires à Londres que de propriétaires? Et est-ce qu'il y a des outils pour réguler, ou tenter de réguler, le prix des loyers?
So in terms of the housing costs, yes, I think the graph I showed since 2008 showed that I think purchase prices have come up by about 70%, rents by about 30%, and wages by about 10%. So yes, rents have been going up faster than wages as well, but not as fast as property prices. So I think in terms of what you're seeing is what they call yield compression in terms of the return on investment for private landlords. The big growth in London recently, and in the UK as a whole, has been in private sector renting. Renting used, we used to be a country with which the majority of households were homeowners. Now the majority of households are renters.
Oh, yes.
Now that's a mixture of private sector renters in the relatively unregulated private market, and renters from local authorities and housing associations where rents are regulated. So that's been a significant shift, and that's partly a result of people. There's some interesting dynamics going on here, that partly a result of people just delaying purchase decisions. And you can see that in household formation in London is much slower than the rest of the UK. So people are delaying the time that they buy and delaying the time perhaps that they form independent households rather than living in a shared property. And that's one thing that is one of the challenges is since the recession, the government has tried to boost demand for housing, which was never a problem in London. The problem in London was always supply. So there's always been an interesting dynamic in London during that period. But in terms of regulating rents, it's something the mayor has raised as a possible measure for his next term. And people have talked quite a lot about what we've seen in Berlin, for example, in terms of what the city government there has been doing. I think the question would be, particularly private developers developing for rent are, as you would expect, lobbying very heavily against rent control. I think the challenge would be to introduce a form of rent control or regulation that didn't simply stifle investment into the type of housing that's housing a lot of Londoners. What's interesting is the abuse of rent. Like currently the rental system for most tenancies is that you have a tenancy of a year. After 6 months, you can be evicted with no rationale. And obviously at the end of a year, a landlord is free to put up the rent by 2%, 5%, 10%, whatever he or she wishes. So I think what you're seeing in some of the more progressive landlords in London is they are giving longer tenancies, they're giving 3 or even 5 year tenancies, and they are committing to raise rents only in line with inflation. So I think maybe some measure of self-regulation may come in place. I think the industry would probably be able to manage some sort of longer tenancies with index-linked raises within tenancies. I think a complete model of regulation that tried to bring rents down would be a lot more challenging in terms of its impact on investment and on the market in London. It's odd. In most areas of our life, we love to see small businesses and individual businesses. The problem with renting in London, a lot of people say, is there are too many individual renters, too many individual landlords, and not enough big corporates who actually observe decent standards of customer service, rather than people who are just sort of amateur investors in the housing market.
Et peut-être question complémentaire, quel est le temps moyen de trajet pendulaire entre le domicile et le travail dans l'agglomération de Londres?
What's the average commute time between?
I know it has increased recently. I don't know exactly what I don't know what those numbers are. I think some young people, and some evidence that population growth in central London is still continuing. And anecdotally, talking to the young people in the office, a lot of them are living in very small flats and trading proximity and proximity to all the single bars. But trading proximity to everything the city has for comfort and space and those considerations that happen when you're older. It's when people are older and start forming families that they tend to start trading the big commutes. But I don't know the figures, I can find them.
But I think there's a tendency at the moment to exaggerate the extent to which more people are moving out to commute back in. I mean, I think that's not true, actually. I mean, the growth recently has just been a cyclical recovery from this. So the out-migration had shrunk after the financial crisis, and it's increased to something normal again currently. But it's also, what happens is more complicated than the story that people suggest. I mean, there is no long-term trend for commuting into London to increase, even though I don't know how many million people have moved out of London during the last 55 years or something like that. At times it was running at 100,000 a year. So there's millions of people who've moved out. Almost all of them to commute back in to start with, and almost none of them doing it by the end of their career. So there's a dynamic process which happens where people keep a job in London, move somewhere outside, then they just either get older, like they get into their 30s, or 40s, in their old age like that, and they get tired of it, or they just discover that there are more jobs locally than they knew about. But something of that kind has been going on for decades, and there's a very sort of naive notion that actually everybody's having to commute back in again. The growth in commuting that recently that's occurred is, I think, straightforwardly a function of the growth of jobs in London, and that they can't be met for the London population. So more people who are already outside have taken jobs in central London in the last decade than previously, because there's been this explosion of jobs rather than the movement of people. Can I say one other thing about this? Because I think there's a missing element. Well, the numbers on rents, I'm not sure I necessarily believe as being real, because the mix of flats that's covered by it will have changed quite a lot. Right, and I think there's been a growth of small flats, that's one thing, but also there's been a growth of rental accommodation not in the centre. So historically, we thought about the suburbs as being entirely owner-occupied, and the inner city as being very largely rented. And that's changed really quite dramatically in the last 10, 20 years because of the difficulty of people getting access to owner-occupation. But the other part of that's the story that Richard was telling about yields and so on, is about expectations of capital appreciation. So a reason why prices go up more than rents go up is because it's an investment. But back of that, if you think about the land rather than the housing, then there's a story to be told about the failure of housing to be built in London, because why would you waste the land on building houses on it now? So when densities in London, residential densities in London increased by 140%, between the late 90s and the mid-2000s, right? Very dramatically, tightening up of land supply. That's good news, right? You get more houses on. The amount of housing that's actually built went up by something like 15 to 20%. So the amount of land that was being built on fell by 50% or so. And it fell, in my understanding of it, it fell because developers, landowners, could get the income stream that they wanted by using a smaller amount of the land at higher density, and hang on to the rest in the expectation that prices are going to be higher and higher and higher, given a region in which land supply is very inelastic. So Greenbelt is part of the story. The restrictions on land supply out in the rest of the region have an impact upon house building within London as well as outside, because of what they imply about expectations of future land value changes and future house price changes. I'd say this crude way of putting it, why would you want to waste the land now, I think is quite a lot of the logic. If you can finance it, if you're a big landowner who's got access to finance, then the incentive to develop much of it now are not very high.
Dans la continuité de ce sujet, on nous a montré hier un très très fort développement de la city en nombre d'immeubles à produire. Quelle est la capacité finalement du Grand Londres à absorber en services, en capacité de logement, etc., en transport, cet important développement? Est-ce qu'il y a une planification de long terme?
The London plan starts with an assumption of continuing growth. That's the basis of the planning within the London plan. And the London plan takes an overview of everything from transport infrastructure to energy infrastructure to water and sewage infrastructure. So there is an expectation of continuing growth. One of the interesting things that's happened after the end of Ian's slide that he showed earlier is net growth in London has been running at about 100,000 people a year. And I think in 2016-17, it went down to about 50,000 people net growth. So London's growth rate has slowed. We don't know whether that is the beginning of a long-term trend or whether that's a simple, perhaps, adjustment during the uncertainties of the Brexit process. But London is still, at the moment, is assuming a continuing level of growth. I think it goes up to about 11 million by 2030, but I'd have to check the precise number. And the London plan, in as far as it can strategic plan to respond to that growth, is planning the investments needed to respond to that. That requires, however, these superhuman efforts to increase housing production by 50% at a time of economic uncertainty. moving from central development to some local development in very difficult sites. And the plan says all sorts of things about what needs to be provided. The plans and the mayor's ability to provide all those things are a lot more limited. But who knows? We don't know. For many years, London underestimated its potential, its growth projections. Whether we're now overestimating our growth projections is an interesting question.
I have a position on this. There's a draft London plan which was prepared by the mayor late 2017, right? It eventually got to an examination in public in February, I think, of this year, and it's due to go on until May of this year. And for my sins, I've sat through, I don't know, probably 10 sessions of this contributing to dialogue. Anything which has been about housing, I've not come across anybody in the room who believes the targets, the projections of what's going to be built in London, apart from the GLA staff and members of the London Assembly. Who professes to believe it? No, absolutely. So I don't think the officers believe it either. So this is a mayoral belief. It's a mayoral choice to believe that houses will be built as a convenience, not to have to think about, well, maybe they should release some greenbelt land in London and there should be a review of greenbelt, or maybe there should be serious discussions, and this is something that Richard's written around, as well as the Centre for London's written around, with neighbours outside in the rest of the region. I have a stake in this. There was an Outer London Commission that Boris Johnson appointed, which in the last years of his mayoralty looked at what the next plan might do about accommodating growth, and came up with very strong recommendations to pursue both of these lines, and said it was necessary to do that. And this mayor has chosen not to do that, as his predecessor would have chosen not to do that, because it's politically difficult. They don't want to get into difficult dialogues with the suburbs about removing the status of green belt, and they don't want to get into difficult dialogues with neighbours outside about that. I think they will have to do so. But I think in the view of most of the people who've been participating in discussions in the last 3 months about this plan, there is an area of enormous unrealism about this. And it's not quite clear what you can do about it. The House Builders Federation representative, James Spencer, is it? I think, was suggesting that what should be done was simply to throw out this plan, use the existing one, and tell the London planners to write a new one. I have a lot of sympathy with that. I'm not sure whether it's realistic. But so we have a real problem about this, and it's to do with the political difficulties of thinking some of these things, not just objective circumstances, difficult though those are.
I think one other element is also the mayor needs to continue to profess the growth, and no one needs to continue to profess belief in growth and belief in accommodating growth, because that is the basis on which he makes his case for infrastructure investment, yes. Central government, which continues to control all the money. So this is part of the same system.
Bonjour. J'ai l'impression qu'il y a un paradoxe entre tout ce qu'on nous a dit ces dernières heures, un jour, puisqu'on est encore deuxième jour, hein, entre la fierté des gens d'être dans un territoire, dans un comté, etc., dans un tissu social proche, et ce que je comprends de l'organisation des collectivités, où finalement elles sont sous tutelle budgétaire, de l'État, elles sont sous tutelle de l'État, puisque c'est l'État qui...
Pardon, vous pouvez répéter, désolé.
Le micro ne marche plus.
Allô?
Oui.
Et les collectivités sont sous tutelle de l'État puisqu'elles reçoivent l'argent du gouvernement. Et je me dis que si on est sous tutelle de quelqu'un de plus fort que soi, et notamment financièrement, finalement on n'a aucune liberté de décision localement pour mettre en œuvre des politiques, quoi, et conduire des projets. Donc pour moi c'est une situation très paradoxale.
Je me permets de rajouter un petit point, justement, c'est beaucoup de pays occidentaux sont aujourd'hui bousculé par une demande démocratique sur les notions de démocratie participative. Citoyens qui veulent avoir des budgets participatifs, qui veulent être tirés au sort des jurys citoyens pour évaluer les politiques publiques. Donc à la suite de cette première question, est-ce que cette demande-là existe à Londres? Si tel est le cas, est-ce qu'elle a un impact sur l'aménagement du territoire et les choix publics qui sont faits avec cette contrainte que les budgets ne sont pas à Londres mais ailleurs?
I'm afraid I didn't fully understand the first question, but I'll come on to the second, maybe, and maybe we'll get on to the same subjects. Sorry? Budgets. In terms of this, we'll come back to the first one, perhaps we could just expand a little bit. In terms of the second one, there has been some interest in these areas, and we've actually looked at some of the stuff going on in Paris. We did a piece on Madame Le Maire, Jeune Idée, a project that has been going on in Paris recently. Something that was brought in during the coalition government of 2010-2015 was this idea of greater localism, greater devolution of power to more local levels. The main initiative that's come out of that has been less about budgeting and more about planning, where there was the introduction of neighbourhood planning, where neighbourhood forums, individual area-based communities, could develop land use plans for their area and had to be supported by local government to do that, and could also do other things such as designating assets of community value that need to be preserved. And that's had some purchase in London. It's mainly had purchase in bourgeois areas where people are quite articulate and quite capable of taking control of the planning process. It's been less impactful in low-income areas, so there's an interesting challenge there. But London is rich in social movements. Generally, there's a strong social movement arguing in terms of the London Plan called Just Space, which is a network of organisations seeking a more devolved power structure for planning. It's been less the case in terms of budgeting. That may be partly because when One London Borough went to neighbourhood budgeting in the 1980s, it indirectly led to the election of a far-right councillor. It was very controversial at the time. I think because devolving the budgets allowed them to be taken over by particular interest groups, and it became very politically complex. So I think maybe devolution of budgets is something that's seen as more controversial and more difficult in London. But there's a move towards neighbourhood governance. It's something we want to do more work on, because it feels as if there's more discussion about neighbourhood governance and what's the correct term? Subsidiarity. Then there is actually a realization of that. Come back on the first question.
En fait, pour moi, il y a un paradoxe culturel.
Parce qu'on n'est pas dans la technique habituelle.
Paradoxe culturel, je
En fait, ma question, elle est plus culturelle qu'économique. Pour moi, il y a un paradoxe à vivre localement, décider localement, et avoir une fierté de vivre et de travailler, d'habiter localement, et d'avoir une autonomie pour décider des infrastructures locales, des services locaux, etc. Et tel que vous l'exposez, si on n'a pas l'argent pour conduire ces politiques publiques, je me dis qu'on n'est pas autonome, et il y a un lien qui se fait pas, il y a un hiatus, et c'est juste ce que je voudrais comprendre. C'est vraiment pas économique, c'est plutôt culturel de mon point de vue, mais si vous pouvez vous éclairer.
Can I take up one aspect? One of the things I'm not sure about is how far you understand the social geography of this city as opposed to Paris. And I have a colleague used to explain to me, urban economist, that London was basically Paris inside out, or Paris was basically London inside out. So when we talk about the suburbs, we talk about places that have traditionally been middle class, and the poor have been concentrated in the middle, along with a few of the rich. But basically there was an income gradient which went up as you went further out. So the suburban areas, which tended to be the ones which had quite strong democratic, one's kind of strong democratic involvement in borough decision making,
they did vary culturally, from certainly from the inner areas, and they vary culturally from each other. And they had very strong different kinds of priorities. So if you mention the word Bromley in the London context, it brings to mind a certain kind of defensiveness about invasion of the territory by working class people, about building more houses there and intruding on the green land and so on, which is definitely cultural. It's embodied also in expectations about the house prices and so on. But so, as Richard was saying, quite a lot of the democratic things that we understand actually in practice can tend to be rather conservative. But I do think that borough politics in London has, at that level, has embodied very strong cultural impacts reflecting different communities in different places. It's one of the things that actually makes the city hard to govern, is this heterogeneity and the different... how hard it is to aggregate preferences across the city as a whole. But the level of the city as a whole, I would have thought that the cultural politics was more ethnic, in some respects, more in terms of broad social classes than in terms of other more sophisticated cultural values, except being rather liberal. I don't think the London mayoralty is a great democratic institution in the terms that you're thinking about, because I don't think there's much of a link that can be made at that level between the provision of services and the limited information which once in every 4 years electors supply to the governmental system. Right. So if there is a democratic politics in London that's effective, I would expect it to be in boroughs, and I think it's been severely constrained in relation to expenditure, in terms by general austerity, but nevertheless it exists at a cultural level. And if you hear people in the examinations in public, they talk for Kingston and Bromley and Enfield in ways that speak to their particular communities and mixes of communities. So I don't know if that answers any of your question, but I think there is a culture of election which is very important.
Can I add one consideration there? And I think there is that cultural difference in where spending power lies and where people identify. However, I suppose I don't... One of the interesting things about London is I don't think people geographically identify very strongly with their borough. People identify as Londoners, and they also, oddly... tend to use the pre-1965 description of their neighbourhoods, the old administrative geography, to talk about where they live. So someone who lives here, which I suspect is Islington, would say they live in Finsbury. Finsbury hasn't existed formally since 1965. When I lived in South London, I lived in Stockwell or I lived in Brixton. I didn't live in Lambeth. That was my borough. But Lambeth is something big and amorphous. So people's personal identity tends to be much more localised than London Borough. And London Borough is odd because it is something that sends you a bill once a year for its council taxes and you vote for once every few years. But it's not a strongly felt geography. Whether there would be an argument, local government reorganisation is always very difficult. I'm not arguing here that we should revert to smaller geographies or even that we should, as some have argued, amalgamate the boroughs, but they're not natural objects that people attach identity to.
I said Finsbury because if you look along the corridor, there are two maces in a case out there, one of which is the mace of the Finsbury Council mayor that used to exist, and the other is the university's mace. So it speaks to the continuing symbolic significance of these things. And just one addendum to that. When I said Bromley, I was speaking about one of the conservative outer ring votes, which didn't think it belonged to London for a long time. So the Greater London Council was created in 1965. It was abolished in 1985. I think 1985 was probably the first time in which opinion poll surveys suggested that a majority of people who lived in outer London thought they lived in London, as opposed to the counties outside which they previously belonged to. So Bromley residents still, many of them think they live in Kent rather than in London at all. So there's an issue about community taking a long time to build up.